The Sunstone Foundation presents Restorations, William Blake and Joseph Smith. Recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We now take you to the University of Utah campus where the program is about to begin.
Who was the figure whose books of prophecy, after very modest beginnings, came to exercise such an impact on Western culture? Who was this mystical man who received revelation upon revelation, who scorned the established religions of his day, who knew that the God the other churches worshipped was a false god, little more than a tyrant? Who was it who so vehemently opposed priestcraft and wrote of the dangers of wicked kings and leaders? Who was it who, when still a young man, worked with metal plates on which were placed mysterious engravings that only a seer could divine? Who was it that saw in vision the new Jerusalem, built far to the west of the old Jerusalem, built upon a sacred land where Jesus himself once walked? Who was it that saw the marriage in the churches as an affront to God, and proposed that a man and woman must be united in a more complete, holy way? Indeed, who was it that flouted Christian matrimonial tradition and outraged his own wife by proposing that she allow him a second wife, a concubine, to raise up seed to himself? If you guessed Joseph Smith, you were correct. But if you guessed William Blake, poet, painter, and engraver, you get extra points for surpassing powers of discernment. William Blake, British poet, painter, engraver, and artistic prophet, died in England about a month before Joseph Smith received the golden plates from an angel. The two could not have known or known of each other, could not have known of each other, and yet they are tied together with an unusual bond which I am at a loss to explain, though I will now attempt to describe that bond. William Blake and Joseph Smith were restorationists in the best sense of that word. They restored divine truth where once had reigned only confusion and falsehood. Joseph Smith's calling was religious and social. His task was, through revelation from on high, to restore true Christianity and lay the foundation for the political, economic, and social kingdom of God on earth. William Blake's task, also divinely commissioned, was to restore visual and poetic art to the glory it once had, but had lost through the wickedness of humankind, as well as to reveal to man the heaven and hell within him, his own psyche. In the England of the 17th century, there had been a restoration, the reinstatement of the British monarchy after the Civil War of the Cromwell era. John Milton, militant Republican, ever the opponent of the monarchy, might not have survived this restoration had not powerful friends intervened in his behalf. Yet the greatest epic of English literature, perhaps of any literature, appeared during the last years of Milton's life, during the reign of Charles II. The arts came alive again with the flourishing of translations of Greek manuscripts newly discovered. The poets found the epitome of grace in the heroic couplet. The odes and pastorals, satires, and mock epics prevailed. Architecture was grand. Apparel was flamboyant. Paintings celebrated heroic victories at sea and on land. Music reached a zenith of sorts with the development and maturation of symphonic and operatic form. Here, indeed, was a restoration worthy of the name. Yet not so. In spite of the glories of this restoration, it was a false restoration. For though it had the glitter and show of the Augustan age, for which it also was named, it had also much of its wickedness and cruelty. In this age, art served the ends of the kings and princes, the state, much more than it served the people. Its social order was the great chain of being, which created some men clearly superior to others. Its religion was for the rich and the aristocratic, and for the poor, as Milton noted, religion was the opportunity for the priest to shear the sheep in the flock rather than to lead them. God was a distant being of pure intellect, unconcerned and unfeeling, unless, of course, he were used by the clergy as a vengeful tyrant to keep the poor and unenfranchised in their places. Colonial oppression was the key to success in all exploits in foreign lands. Oppression and economic exploitation. The slave trade boomed, and man's inhumanity to man was counterbalanced on the scales of justice with shipments of tea, spice, sugar, and tobacco. It was the era of Western man's greatest arrogance, typified in Diderot's Encyclopédie, which implied that man had finally learned all there was to know. It is into the latter part of this reawakening that William Blake was born in 1757. The false restoration did not begin with the ascension of Charles II to the throne in 1660, and it cannot be said that dissenting voices were not heard during his lifetime and beyond, for after all, the Whigs continued to gain power in Parliament long after Charles was gone and continued so to do clear through the Hanoverian dynasty. But the irony of that dissent is that it rarely went toward promoting justice, equality, gentleness, religious liberty, or truly great art, as the Cromwell era bears ample witness. It merely furthered the interests of the merchants. The monarchy would fall to a new generation of bankers and shipping magnates. But into this era, Blake was born. And it is against the foolishness of the establishment of his era, Whig or Tory, that Blake waged artistic warfare. Most students of English, even graduate students, know Blake's achievement only slightly, through the Songs of Innocence and Experience, relatively early engraved works, and those particularly through the Lamb and the Tiger. The prophetic Blake is scarcely revealed in those early works, though he is there. It is in his prophetic works, both early and late, and in his prose commentaries that one finds the truly revelatory. For instance, in the early tractate, There Is No Natural Religion, we read, "Therefore God becomes as we are, that we may be as he is." Who among the Latter-day Saints does not hear in such a statement echoes of D&C 130, verse 1? "When the Savior shall appear, we shall see him as he is. We shall see that he is a man like ourselves." Or in another tractate, All Religions Are One, we read, "Thus all sects of philosophy are from the poetic genius adapted to the weakness of every individual." This statement finds its counterpart in the Word of Wisdom, adapted to the capacity of the weak and the weakest of all saints. The parallel passages occur over and over again between Blake's and Joseph Smith's writings. It is not my purpose, however, to cite mere parallel passages, except as it tends to show that Blake revealed art in the same way Joseph Smith revealed religion, through direct divine intervention. And why was this necessary? Because God had witnessed a great apostasy in art and wished to correct it. Art was not to be imitative, but revelatory, itself a creation of God rather than an imitation of one of God's creations. How such an apostasy in art could occur is explained in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. Revelation gave way to memory, or tradition, which became dogmatized and established through a priesthood of false poets that enslaved men by making literal that which was meant to be only figurative. "The ancient poets," says Blake, "animated all sensible objects with gods or geniuses, calling them by the names and adorning them with the properties of woods, rivers, mountains, lakes, cities, nations, and whatever their enlarged and numerous senses could perceive. And particularly, they studied the genius of each city and country, placing it under its mental deity, till a system was formed, which some took advantage of and enslaved the vulgar by attempting to realize or abstract the mental deities from their objects. Thus began priesthood, or priestcraft, choosing forms of worship from poetic tales, and at length they pronounced that the gods had ordered such things. Thus men forgot that all deities reside in the human breast." It is the systematizing of art, the establishment of one type of art to dominate all the others, without the spirit of the poetic genius, that enslaves men's minds. And the true prophet, the poet struggling against this tide of oppression, faces a harrowing battle for truth. Tradition alone dictates what is beautiful, and the poetic genius is left to languish or to be actively sought out and destroyed. Blake's frustrations as a poet-prophet are revealed in a letter to Reverend Tressler in 1799. "I really am sorry that you are fallen out with the spiritual world, especially if I should have to answer for it. I feel very sorry that your ideas and mine on moral painting differ so much as to have made you angry with my method of study. If I am wrong, I am wrong in good company. I had hoped your plan comprehended all species of this art, and especially that you would not regret that species which gives existence to every other, namely vision of eternity. You say that I want somebody to elucidate my ideas, but you ought to know that what is grand is necessarily obscure to weak men. That which can be made explicit to the idiot is not worth my care." And what was the subject of the overwhelming majority of Blake's paintings, engravings, and poems? The plan of salvation. Blake died in relative obscurity, and it was only after his death that his artistic and poetic message caught fire. But those that read Blake or study his painting are relatively few. Those that read with understanding are but a handful. And the Reverend Dr. Tressler was not one of them, it is apparent. Why is Blake's art shrouded in such mystery? Because we lack somebody to elucidate his ideas. Who is qualified to elucidate? Certainly not the Blake critics, if they will forgive my arrogance. They are the least qualified, because they see only with the ratio. It takes a visionary to see a visionary. As Blake declared, "He who sees the infinite in all things sees God. He who sees the ratio only sees himself only." When the critics write about Blake, we see the critics, not Blake. Who then will open Blake to us? Why not the visionaries among us? By that I don't necessarily mean the Mormons, unless we are speaking of visionary Mormons, who make some of the best visionaries of all. I mean those who have truly partaken of the visions of eternities. Joseph Smith could and did teach us worlds about William Blake. I owe all my intuitive understanding of William Blake to Joseph Smith. But any of us who are visionaries can approach the text or the painting without fear. It is interesting that Blake communed with the spirits of the great prophets, in particular Ezekiel and Isaiah. I find it ironic that it is those prophets that the Latter-day Saints have the hardest time reading and understanding. Yet Nephi and Jesus cherished Isaiah, as did Joseph Smith. I suspect that part of the reason we shy away from Ezekiel and Isaiah is the same reason we shy away from William Blake and from Joseph Smith's more ecstatic visions. We are not very often visionary ourselves, and to us the text is a mass of confusion. We are afraid of the vision, or perhaps afraid of our lack of vision. And how shall I justify looking at Blake's work in this manner? Because he declared that he was a prophet. The angelic child commands Blake from the very first, "Piper, sit thee down and write in a book that all may read." So he vanished from my sight, and I plucked a hollow reed. It does not matter one whit that the vast majority of biographers and critics, from Wordsworth on, with the notable exceptions of Ellis and Yeats, have stated either that Blake was insane or that he meant what he said only metaphorically. But if we take Joseph Smith or Ezekiel or Jesus at their word, we must take Blake at his word. He writes, "I write when commanded by the spirits, and the moment I have written, I see the words fly about the room in all directions. It is then published, and the spirits can read." And what is the sign of Blake's calling as poet-prophet? The miraculous method of engraving his art and poetry. The method, Blake claims, was revealed to him in a vision by his younger brother Robert, who had died, but with whom Blake had had spiritual contact for many years. Though again, the critics have pointed to this or that practical influence on Blake's concept of illuminated printing, Blake maintained that it had been given him in a vision. Stanley Kunitz, at least acknowledges that Blake meant what he said when he wrote to Thomas Butts, "I am not ashamed, afraid, or averse to tell you what ought to be told, that I am under the direction of messengers from heaven, daily and nightly." This method, which involved drawing on copper plates with impervious liquids, then eating away the untouched parts with acid, allowed Blake to produce miniatures of inimitable mystery and beauty. And his great poetic works are preserved upon some of these copper plates, as well as upon the paper against which the plates were pressed. These works include the songs previously mentioned, and the Marriage of Heaven and Hell, as well as the minor and major prophetic works. I will quote short passages from these works to allow you to become more comfortable with the restoration as envisioned by Blake. This is from the Marriage. "Without contraries is no progression." Does this sound familiar to those who have read Lehi's discourses? From the Book of Thel, a passage in which a pre-existent soul named Thel is encouraged by a man-like cloud to enter mortality and not fear it, or sexuality, or death, for ultimately she will gain eternal life and eternal union with a partner. "O maid, I tell thee, when I pass away, it is to tenfold life, to love, to peace, and raptures holy. Unseen descending, weigh my light wings upon balmy flowers, and court the fair-eyed youth to take me to her shining tent. The weeping virgin trembling kneels before the risen sun, till we arise, linked in a golden band, and never part, but walk united." This is from America, a Prophecy, in which the fate of the eastern cities is described. "Fury, rage, madness, and a wind swept through America, and the red flames of Orc revolution that folded roaring fierce around the angry shores, and the fierce rushing of the inhabitants together. The citizens of New York closed their books and locked their chests. The mariners of Boston dropped their anchors and unlaid. The scribe of Pennsylvania casts his pen upon the earth. The builder of Virginia throws his hammer down in fear." It is, of course, assumed that this passage refers only to the American Revolution, which had already passed. But could it also describe something familiar to us in the Doctrine and Covenants, section 84? "Nevertheless, let the bishop go up into the city of New York, also to the city of Albany, and also to the city of Boston, and warn the people of those cities with the sound of the gospel, with a loud voice, of the desolation and utter abolishment which await them if they do reject these things. For if they do reject these things, the hour of their judgment is nigh, and their houses shall be left unto them desolate." From the Book of Urizen, here a passage describing the Decalogue as a snare for those who see it as an end in itself. Compare with the brass plates of Laban. "Lo, I unfold my darkness, and on this rock place with strong hand the book of eternal brass written in my solitude." Here's a passage from Milton describing the three classes of men, very much analogous to the three degrees of glory in D&C 76. "And the three classes of men, regulated by Los's hammer, the first, the elect from before the foundation of the world, the second, the redeemed, the third, the reprobate and formed to destruction from the mother's womb." Here is a passage from Jerusalem describing the exaltation of mankind in the eternities. "And they conversed together in visionary forms dramatic, which bright rebounded from their tongues in thunderous majesty, in visions, in new expanses, creating exemplars of memory and of intellect, creating space, creating time, according to the wonders divine of human imagination." Thus, my advice to all is not to judge William Blake by two poems, The Lamb and the Tiger, for there is a whole new Bible out there, the Bible of Hell, called so because it was the complement to the original Bible, much as we regard the Book of Mormon as a complement to the Bible. Blake did indeed restore something that was lost, revealed art. Blake's preface to Milton sums up his mission and ours very precisely. "The stolen and perverted writings of Homer and Ovid, of Plato and Cicero, which all men ought to contemn, are set up by artifice against the sublime of the Bible. But when the new age is at leisure to pronounce, all will be set right, and those grand works of the more ancient and consciously and professedly inspired men will hold their proper rank, and the daughters of memory shall become the daughters of inspiration. Shakespeare and Milton were both curbed by the general malady and infection from the silly Greek and Latin slaves of the sword. Rouse up, O young men of the new age. Set your foreheads against the ignorant hirelings. Painters, on you I call. Sculptors, architects, suffer not the fashionable fools to depress your powers by the prices they pretend to give for contemptible works or the expensive advertising boasts that they make of such works. Believe Christ and his apostles that there is a class of men whose whole delight is in destroying. We do not want either Greek or Roman models if we are but just and true to our own imaginations, those worlds of eternity in which we shall live forever in Jesus our Lord. Thank you.
Peter Sorensen asks us to believe that Joseph Smith and William Blake were both visionaries and directed in their life's occupations by visions and revelations. Okay, I'll buy that. I don't think Joseph Smith or Mormons have a corner on revelations. When I hear that as a boy of eight, Blake saw on Peckham Rye a tree filled with angels, I don't discount it. I've heard stranger things from Brother Joseph's history. When I hear William Blake also claimed that, quote, great men of all times and all countries appeared to him, usually at night, and kept his pencil busy as he sketched them, and as they also dictated to him long passages of his poems, I am not incredulous. I am envious. I wish they would visit me and dictate a little. I invite them. But Peter Sorensen also seems to be asking us to believe that Joseph Smith and William Blake were not only both visionaries, but were actually receiving very similar, if not identical, visions. According to Sorensen, Blake's visions informed and shaped both the content and method of his art, while Joseph Smith's visions shaped the structure and doctrines of a new religion and the thinking and behavior of his followers. Joseph's task was just to restore true Christianity, Blake's to restore visual and poetic art. Blake's visions led him to do battle against a priesthood of false poets. Joseph Smith was led into battle with a priesthood of false religions. This makes a nice metaphor, but Sorensen goes beyond metaphor. He wants us to find parallel passages. I am less comfortable with this. However, Sorensen, I believe, rightly points out that the extensive interpretive keys critics have provided to help us make sense of Blake often get in the way of Blake's poetry communicating to us as poetry. For instance, here's an example of a scheme for Jerusalem, one of the longer late prophetic works of Blake's, from Damon's Blake Dictionary. It's a large chart, different geographical directions, northeast, south, and west, correspond or associated with different controlling figures such as Urthona, Luva, Urizen, Tharmas, and these are also connected with different human or psychic tendencies and so on and so on. It's quite an extensive list of connections to hold in your mind as you're trying to work on this. At one point in his essay, Sorensen comments, I owe all my intuitive understanding of William Blake to Joseph Smith. Intuitive is the word that struck me as providing a truly valuable directive to reading William Blake, namely, use an intuitive approach. A right-brained or a visionary, if you will, approach to Blake rather than an analytical one. The elaborate scholarly apparatus university students and professors often use to interpret Blake leads them to experience his poetry as mind-boggling intellectual puzzles in fancy verbal wrappers, fun to unwrap and decode for papers maybe, but not poetry. However, Sorensen goes further than simply suggesting an intuitive approach. He suggests, as I mentioned, that we parallel passages with the Doctrine and Covenants. As a respondent, I owe him some willing suspension of disbelief, so I've taken the leap of faith and tried to reread Blake as a closet Mormon. How similar to Mormon thought is Blake's religious philosophy? Well, I stumbled over as many striking differences as Sorensen did similarities. To mention only two, Blake seems to be light years ahead of Joseph Smith in understanding the dangers of, one, patriarchy in religious institutions, and two, patriarchy in marriage. One of Blake's most delightful inventions is the name Old Nobodaddy, out of Nobody and Daddy, perhaps, for the jealous patriarchal god of official Christianity. This Old Nobodaddy is, according to Blake's thinking, an invention of the established churches, intending to defend that establishment. God is only an allegory of kings and nothing else, Blake says. God is the ghost of the priest and king, committed to the defense of the established order. Priest, king, tyrant, Old Nobodaddy are all of an inimical kind for Blake. Joseph Smith, on the other hand, seems not to have regarded kings and priests, queens and priestesses, as roles deserving of contempt or as always synonymous with tyranny. Urizen is another portrait of the patriarchal impulse, the god with calipers, measuring things out, jealous of his domain, perhaps adding up his wives and children to see how high he will rank in the kingdom. Depending upon reason, repressing emotion, Urizen is the great forbidder. In the marriage of heaven and hell, Blake suggests over and over again that self-restraint is not strength of will, but weakness of desire. I quote, "I tell you, no virtue can exist without breaking these Ten Commandments. Jesus was all virtue and acted from impulse, not from rules." Now, I tend to agree with Blake, but I don't find this a real strong theme in the Doctrine and Covenants. In the Visions of the Daughters of Albion, Blake explores in great detail the dangers of repression and bondage, especially in sexual and marital relations. Oothon, the female, like Oothite, Oothon, the female spirit yearning for unfettered love, sounds like a poetized Mary Wollstonecraft, who is Blake's British contemporary, who wrote her prophetic Vindication of the Rights of Women in 1792. Blake's Visions of the Daughters of Albion was engraved in 1793. Rather than a closet Mormon, my rereading of Blake this time turned up a closet feminist. Perhaps, however, I am simply insufficiently visionary, as were those other Blake critics, whom Sorensen so easily dismisses in Bags and Balesful. So let me examine some other questions that Sorensen's essay raises for me that I may be better equipped to deal with, such as, what is the difference between a poet-prophet and a prophet-seer and revelator-prophet? What differing claims do they make upon our lives? Although art often has religious, moral, and even doctrinal themes, most of us do not approach a work of art as a religious or doctrinal tract, despite some of the higher claims which have been made for poetry, especially in the 19th century. For most of the 18th century, Pope's prescription that the poet's role was to inscribe in verse what oft was thought but ne'er so well expressed, was the rather pedestrian understanding of the role of art, or at least of poetry. However, in the late 18th century and on into the 19th century, with Blake as one of the earliest manifestations, the view of the poet's role shifted radically to that of poet as vates, or a seer and revelator of higher truths. I think, for instances, of Wordsworth's Prelude, Shelley's Prometheus Unbound, or much later even of W.B. Yeats' A Vision and his cosmic gyres of history, or in New England of the Transcendentalist movement led by Emerson, who left the clergy to follow his own compelling and iconoclastic visions of human divinity. Among the British intellectuals, at least, many individuals looked to poets rather than religious leaders for revelation and visions. Matthew Arnold, toward the end of the 19th century, in The Function of Criticism, a real key article, essay of his, argued that more and more mankind will discover that we have to turn to poetry to interpret life for us, to console us, to sustain us. Without poetry, our science will appear incomplete, and most of what now passes with us for religion and philosophy will be replaced by poetry. That prophecy was made 100 years ago and has come to pass in a parallel universe, where literature professors are very well paid and TV laureates evangelize with Sunday morning readings, and Edgar A. Guest is being sued for fraud and being defrocked for having an affair with his secretary. Let me suggest two reasons why Arnold's prophecy regarding the high destiny of poetry did not come to pass in our universe. First, art is primarily an agent of power, not an object of knowledge or a container for ideas. Like a powerful painting or a moving symphony, poetry happens to us. We experience it. As one critic, Yaus, puts it, literature is a current event, not a past event, and one which keeps happening or it is dropped from the canon of great literature. What poetry has to say is part of its power, especially with Blake, but that intellectual content, the idea content, is not what makes it poetry. Quartets. A Dr. Myers in the anthropology department at BYU initiated a monthly discussion group at his home for Eliot enthusiasts. I went once, but it made Eliot too much public property. Our relationship was a personal and private encounter, not a subject for public discussion or worship. Though it may sound heretical, I think that sometimes these mentor friends may be more important than prophets here and revelator prophets in shaping who we are. A last question that Sorensen's essay raises for me is why, despite my sympathy with his intuitive approach, the overall result seems so wrong-headed. The answer, I think, is that he has confused significance with meaning in reading Blake. E.D. Hirsch, in his book Validity in Interpretation, discusses the critical distinction between meaning and significance in literature. Meaning, he says, has to be tied to what the author meant, what was in his or her mind, conscious or subconscious, as the author constructed the text. A text's meaning, then, is tied to the author's life and experiences, and however complex, remains a constant. A text's significance, on the other hand, what it means to us, changes from individual to individual and from one time period to another. For example, Gerard Manley Hopkins' poem, which begins, "Margaret, are you grieving over Golden Grove unleaving?" had a very different significance for me, read at the funeral of a friend's daughter, than it had when I read it years earlier, browsing through a poetry anthology in the library, although I was very moved by it then as well. The significance had changed, the meaning had not. Or to give another example, the significance of Milton's Paradise Lost was obviously very different for Blake than it would have been for an Anglican clergyman. And more recently, the significance of Paradise Lost has been a heated topic among feminist critics. This is not to suggest that significance is irrelevant to the text, or extraneous, or unimportant. In fact, Hirsch feels that the primary object of criticism and critics, after coming at least part way towards interpreting the text's meaning, is its significance. The point is then to take care not to confuse the two, not to assume the text's significance for us, what it means to us, is actually part of the author's intended meaning. Milton did not anticipate and intend the feminist response to Paradise Lost or to Blake's response. That is not part of its meaning, but of its significance. So although Sorensen's essay opens some new possibilities for exploring Blake's significance to us as Mormons, I don't believe Blake was either a closet Mormon or a closet feminist. Though I'm still toying with the idea that he may be an earlier incarnation of Carl Jung or maybe Ed Firmage.